my good friends.
Good evening, everybody. It is
5:32,
and it's March 12th, and March 13th, excuse me. And welcome to the Joint Committee on Public Safety, and we're going to open up an informational hearing at this time. And we have invited testimony this evening, and Shane Griggs, if you would come up and start us off, please.
Hello, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shane Griggs. I'm the Assistant Director for the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division within the Department of Corrections, and I've been invited to provide some information about three practices that we have, the Alternative Incarceration Program, Earn Time, and Transitional Leave. I'll start with the Earn Time, if that's okay. In 1989, the Oregon Legislature enacted Earn Time in association with the sentencing guidelines. Earn Time is applied to specific crimes, and at the time that the inmate is in the sentencing court, the judge determines whether or not he or she is going to be eligible for that Earn Time. It serves as an incentive process that encourages inmates to maintain good conduct and also to participate in programs that we know from evidence that do work to prevent recidivism. And in doing so, they can earn that earlier release period. With appropriate institutional behavior and participation in basic skill programs, including work, the department is authorized to grant that earn time. We do it in 6 months increments, and at that 6 month period, the inmate is evaluated to see whether or not there has been any issues as far as major misconducts or program noncompliance. At that point, the individual can have some or all of their earned time retracted for that period. The earned time process has changed over the decades in relation to changing inmate sentencing requirements and public safety decisions. Currently, the inmates can receive this earned time if it's authorized by the court under 137.750, except as provided by law elsewhere. So, for example, a Measure 11 offender cannot have earned time. Anybody with a determinate sentence under Measure 4 is not eligible for earned time. Currently, earned time is 30% for a very limited class of inmates. However, that 30% will go away July 1st of 2013. The impact of House Bill 3194 with regard to earned time is that the maximum amount of earned time will go to 30% for more offenders. I'll move on to the transitional leave, which we refer to as the short-term transitional leave in this sense. This is a leave by which inmates may be released up to 30 days early after they've done several things, including securing appropriate transitional supports so that they can successfully reenter our communities. They must meet statutory eligibility requirements. They must be in a minimum custody. They may not have a detainer or any other charge pending that would result in incarceration after they move to transitional leave. They must be program compliant, and they must have good conduct. Currently, the process is that the inmate applies for consideration to transitional leave. We have conversations with our community corrections partners, we being the Department of Corrections, and then we make that determination if that's going to be a good candidate for transitional leave. Under House Bill 3194, the change would be that that 30-day transitional leave would move to 90 days from 30 days. The Alternative Incarceration Program, we have two types. I'll refer to it as AIP since I've spelled it out for the record. Two types of AIP authorized under statute. One is an intensive cognitive programming opportunity. Those are available to all levels of inmates as far as risk levels. And then we have an intensive addictions program that involves addictions intervention and treatment. For that, we only offer that to those moderate to high-risk offenders, those most likely to reoffend. AIP program in either case, in either the cognitive or the addictions, is a 270-day program. The first 180 days is in-prison treatment. It's very intense. It's 7 days a week of 14-hour days of programming. If they complete that successfully, then they move to the 90-day non-prison leave. Some of us refer to it often on incorrectly, me, as transitional leave. It was changed in statute. So we were talking about that transitional leave with AIP. It's referred to as non-prison leave. You may see that often on. So if they've completed that in-house treatment successfully, they move to non-prison leave. Following that, then they move on to post-prison supervision with our community corrections partners. It is the discretion at the discretion of the department whether or not to grant that non-prison leave after that 180-day in-prison treatment. Most of you are familiar with the ACRS, which is the automatic criminal risk score. That's the tool that we use to evaluate the likelihood of an individual reoffending. They look at, it's a mathematical equation, which is way out of my comfort zone, but basically seven variables that they look at, and it's a very accurate picture of whether or not somebody's going to reoffend or likely to reoffend when they leave. We have very limited resources, so we do prioritize those resources to those individuals most likely to reoffend. Currently, for crimes committed on or after January 1st of 2009, inmates can receive a maximum of a 20% sentence reduction in addition to earned time for which they may be eligible to receive. The judgment order has to, at this point, state that an inmate is eligible for AIP. The change with House Bill 3194 would be that it would be an opt-out instead of an opt-in. So a judge at sentencing in the sentencing court would have to declare that that inmate is not eligible for AIP. Otherwise, we assume that he or she is. That's a very high level of all three practices within the prison. But in developing these policy options for your consideration, I do know that the commission on public safety explored a lot of research about what other states are doing. You've been exposed to some of that. I wanted to point out two. One was the Georgia 2012 package of reforms, and they looked at managing that population growth through changes to drug and property offense sentences, investments to strengthen our community supervision, and investments in local sanctions, treatment, and drug courts. In Washington State, which is the other state I wanted to point out, they actually moved the amount of good time they increased from 33% to 50% of the total sentence for certain nonviolent drug and property offenders. A follow-up cost-benefit analysis in 2009 found that there was a benefit of about $7,179 per offender by taking that action. Research continues to show us that for most offenders, that length of stay can be decreased without affecting recidivism. At least 14 states have opted to allow that 30% earned time to certain offenders for good behavior and for program compliance. The commission also took the time to look at what Oregon is already doing very well and looked at opportunities for expanding those opportunities. And most of those three that I have pointed out to you, the earned time, and also improving that transitional reentry opportunities for those that are leaving our custody and moving into our neighborhoods. We know that there's a cost-benefit analysis that the Criminal Justice Commission did that stated that every dollar you spend in alcohol and drug treatment in prison has a $1.54 return on that investment, mostly through avoided victimization costs, court costs, conviction supervision, and prison time. And we also know from the Washington State Institute on Public Policy there's a 4 to 9% reduction in recidivism from in-prison treatment. So we know what works. We also know, as you know, that prison population is driven by two things, how many people come in and how long they stay with us. While the number of people going to prison has increased, Oregon offenders are also staying in prison longer than at any other point in the last decade. This increased length of stay is a key driver of the state's prison population growth. The policies outlined by the Commission for AIP, earned time, and transitional release would all address the length of stay. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if I can't, I know Mr. Nasby can.
Questions?
Yeah.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, I probably know less about this than you, so I think you're safe.
Perfect.
But I want to ask you about this Acres risk of persons entering the prison system. You said there were seven variables, and they get a risk score. I'm trying to figure out, and maybe I should ask you what those seven variables are, because there seems to be a sticking point in law enforcement about, you know, sex offenders, and are they considered violent or nonviolent, or does it depend? And are they going to get these scores? Is it going to reflect that they're sex offenders and so forth?
Co-Chair, Senator Close, there's the seven variables. I don't have them all off the top of my head, but some examples are previous criminal behavior, age, alcohol, drug. So the things that age and previous criminal behavior are the two obvious ones that stand out. Would all determine. That is, that ACRS determination is done on every inmate that comes to us through intake, including the sex offenders. It is interesting to note, though, that the sex offenders are the least likely to reoffend. They are our lower risk inmates. So that's an important point to note. Did that answer your question? I can get back to you with all
yes.
seven, but...
That does answer it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. Chain, you talked about earn time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about the impact on the offender's behavior for those who are involved in programs that receive earn time? You know, how is that behavior both inside as well as preparation to go out? Can
right.
you talk to us about that?
I can. Co-chairs and co-chair Senator Winters, all the programs... The Department of Corrections meets that standard of 75% of our programs have to be evidence-based, so they have to work. So not only are we giving them offenders tools to be successful when they reenter, but it is a management tool for us while they're with us. They're very well aware that they, without good behavior, without program compliance, a lot of the liberties that they enjoy, whether it be a job, or et cetera, are at risk. But most importantly, the skills that we give them through that cognitive programming and alcohol and drug treatment, for a lot of our folks, are the first time that they've received any of that treatment. So that is a huge effect.
So how does having the earned time program affect the overall environment inside the prison?
Again, co-chairs and co-chairs Winters, it is a valuable tool for the population in the prisons. Without the earn time, without that sense of, you know, hope or I'm achieving a goal, I don't know what the population would look like in prison. I wouldn't want to be there, but I do know that the earn time is a very valuable tool for the management. I don't think I'm answering your question, but maybe we can talk more off.
Oh, you are. You're answering the question.
Okay, good. Other questions?
Yeah. Are you very familiar with Washington, with what they're doing, especially with their 50% increase, what they've done over the past couple of years?
Right. Only what I've read, and the findings showed that there was a net benefit.
Right. Well, I'm just kind of curious, Shane, and... I mean, I can probably do this research as well, but if you have this at the top of your head right now, I'd be curious to know as to what their population is compared to what we have. I mean, at 14,300 right now.
Right.
What they have.
We can find that. I don't know what their population or their demographic breakout is, but I can check with our Pew partners, and otherwise we can find that for you. And
then the other thing that I'd be interested in knowing is what that size population is, too, that's receiving the 50% right now.
Right.
Anybody else? Okay. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and we're going to, the next panel we have is Lieutenant Will Benson from Baker County and Mark Royal from Umatilla County. Come out. Thanks for coming over.
Way over there. Whatever you'd like.
Okay. Co-chairs, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Royal. I'm the director of Umatilla County Community Corrections. Today, I came to talk about a reentry program, and I provided you some information about that. But Scott Taylor mentioned that maybe we wanted to talk more about the health of our organization and what it might be like in our particular counties. Umatilla County is a small county by comparator to many. We have about 2.1% of the population, and we've been focused in the treatment activity for quite some time. I've been director since 1996, so all our activity has been about evidence-based practices and trying to stay on top of the curve, if you will, as we move forward. And to note, I think we've really enjoyed growth in our particular business and made some great impact on recidivism in Oregon. I was just looking at some of my data notes, and I know a statewide average for recidivism in the PPS population, the post-prison supervision population, was 38% at one time. That was 06, and I think today we're looking at 27%. So we made some real headway there. Although, as you're aware, in 07-09, our particular proposed budget was about $223 to $229 million statewide. Today we're sitting at 181, 182. I realized there was some adjustment in workload when 3508 took place, and so there was some reduction in funds because of that. Although, I would just paint the picture that those are the kind of funds that we utilize to run the programs that we offer. Today's environment is we're lucky to have treatment in the county. And the only reason I've been able to hang on is through drug court grant applications and other granting opportunities. Some of the problem associated with that is you're locked into a certain population, certain design, so it's not good for responsivity in assigning clients to proper treatment that they need. So that's one difficult area. To touch on this particular paper I provided you, this was a good indication of what we felt was a very good practice and promising reentry program. And it was through a partnership with the Department of Corrections that we were able to do this. And on the second page, it indicates for you a timeline. Bottom line is we move people out of the institution at 90 days. And they were in secure custody. They entered our jail. At that time, they received a thorough risk assessment and need assessment, in addition to treatment need assessments as well. They entered a 30-day treatment program, and really, I shouldn't call it treatment because it was more pre-treatment. It's COG-based, get them prepared for actually entry into a structured treatment program. And so then, once they were successful with that, they moved to our work release facility or program center, where they entered their specific track for treatment. And that was at a minimum, like I say, minimum secure custody facility, but it was locked. And then at the last 30 days, people were then kind of given opportunity for real structure around employment opportunities and actually get a job at that point, so they transitioned better into the community. The third page is just a description of the programming things that we offered there and how that process and flow chart would work. And I would just note at the very bottom, the core COG, A&D, criminal relapse prevention, anger management, and communication skills, most of those are gone today. We still have a bare core COG program, and like I say, the A&D program is really drug court oriented. For data sets, it's not much. We started this program in August of 06, and it terminated March of 09 due to the reduction in funding. We just could not no longer afford to keep the facility open, so it's still mothballed at this time. Briefly, we had 199 people we screened, and that was done from our local office. We screened those that we thought would be eligible. Then they went back to the institution, and they did some further screening, and we had some criteria in place that was exclusionary. like they had to have a certain behavioral level. And this says five here, but it was more like three. We might have had some at four. But five is generally a pretty difficult person to work with. Anybody with severe mental health needs, we didn't have that capability in our local jail. And if they were engaged in treatment at DOC, they were excluded as well because they were getting treatment in that facility. And or if they were serving mandatory sentence, Measure 11 or 57, they weren't eligible for that. So of those, 104 were referred to our local jail. 67 of those entered the actual pretreatment program in jail custody. 85% of those completed that 30-day pretreatment. And then finally, half, or 52, entered our program center for their specific tracks, and that's broke down for you about what track they entered. And the data I give you as far as recidivism is certainly no thorough study. It is just an indicator that I provide you with data that I was able to gather off the system. And like I say, it was such a short-lived program, we didn't have enough history to make it statistically significant, but we can show that those in the RUMA program had a 29% recidivism rate 3 years out. That was compared to the statewide average at the time of 38%. And the glaring thing in the middle there, it was our cohort in 2006, the second half, was at 22%. So it's a little higher than our average. But that also was a very low cycle for our county. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Close, go ahead.
Thank you. Can you tell us why you lost, it looks like you lost 30% between pretreatment and the treatment program? Why did those people drop?
Between those referred and those who entered? Yeah, that's the jail portion.
You said 80% of them went to pretreatment and then 50% entered the final treatment.
Okay. Of the 104 that were referred, or 52% of those, there was exclusionary reasons that they couldn't come to our county. Of those that went into the 500 or 900, they had to meet treatment criteria by assessment, like the ASAM, they call it. So that could exclude some people. Let's say that they were identified as being a sex offender and didn't need alcohol and drug treatment. They wouldn't have entered that particular program. And then of those 85% that were successful there and then moved to the program center, there could be other behavioral issues they had and were excluded from movement to the community. Being it was a minimum secure facility and there could be walkaways. Luckily, maybe not luckily, maybe because of this activity, we had no walkaways. We had no problems with the inmates we served.
Thank you.
Senator Pruszanski.
Mark, regarding the transitional leave program, do you have any comments as to how that seems to work as to moving people from DOC back to you? And I guess two parts. Number one, just in general, and two, the time frame. 30 days, and we're looking at potentially 90 days. Would that give you more opportunity to actually do a transition that might be a better fit for the community?
Certainly, I think it would be a benefit. And I believe that at a 90-day pre-release or transitional leave process makes good sense for us. It certainly, for Umatilla County, wouldn't bring us enough money, if you will, to actually open the center, because it's costly to run the center. But we could do day management quite easily. We've had that before. In fact, when we closed this, we did institute a day management program that addressed this same population. The other thing I would comment about that is that it's the same person that's coming out to us. So 90 days, in my opinion, is not going to change anything. I think the same issues we're going to have 90 days early or at release is going to be nearly the same. What it does provide us is some additional funding, so you could put some things in place that make it more successful.
Wonderful. The other question, if I could, Co-Chair.
Go ahead.
So regarding this transition of having people for that 90 days, and one of the goals of this committee is to try to have savings at the state level, mm-hmm. have those reinvested into the communities, not knowing how much it would cost for your program to be reopened. But if we have flexibility for the counties to consider how to reuse that money, do you think if the money was there, you could actually benefit not only people coming out of the state system, but those who are not coming into the state system that's within your jurisdiction?
Yeah, release from jail?
Yes.
Yeah, we could apply the same program. In fact, we did. When we had the program center open, the referrals came both from DOC and our jail. And it could have been the local control population or those sentenced to 12 months or less, and there was a transition for them as well. And the same rules applied. They entered the same program. They came back to us the same way. And then we have even more flexibility with them because the period was longer. We had 6 months at that time. Now that's, you know, it's moved to a lot fewer days, and we can't impact that the same way. And as I mentioned, those are the monies we utilized to do that project.
Right.
And when they disappeared, we just could no longer do it. Did I answer all your questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Senator Winters?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. If you could do the optimum, you know, we're talking 90 days, do you think that an optimum would be more than 90 days or less than 90 days? And I'm thinking because at one time in our history, we actually did have work release.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so if you were to do an optimum and looking at success, where would you put those numbers?
You know, I think it depends on the program, but there's one work group I'm working with in our local area, Eastern Oregon, and with GOBI and the CCOs in our particular area about moving people out early from the prison that have mental illness. And that particular model that we're looking at, when I did the data sets, what made sense to us at the time was 6 months. And that because the transition is a little tougher when you're dealing with a mentally ill population. There's certainly enough of them to, you know, get the proper referral. And a facility like that, I think we could put in place if we can make the proper agreements. And that's, you know, that's the hard part, that devil's in the details, and we need to work all those. I know that that's floating the hall somewhat, at least consideration of an alternative to the closure of BMRC. And part of that population, I say again, is corrections and from the prison system and or local jail. And I believe the six-month window for that group makes more sense. And it may, again, 6 months early, 90 days early, or upon release, it's the same body we're dealing with every day. It's not a new population. It's not a new inmate. These people we deal with every day.
Okay, Lieutenant Benson.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me today. I appreciate it. My name is Will Benson. I'm a lieutenant with the Baker County Sheriff's Office, and I manage the Parole and Probation Division. I'm going to talk today briefly about kind of the good and the bad and how we're trying to manage it. I'm going to start with the bad. When I started with Baker County in 2007, we had a pretty healthy budget. It was nice for community corrections. I had a staff of six, and we were able to do a lot of different things. As that money dwindled and due to cuts and things of that nature, my staff is now cut in half. My budget is cut in half, and we have had to eliminate a number of things, with our core duty being sanctions and warrants. We had to protect that at all costs, and everything we did on the other side of that to reduce recidivism and make these offenders productive members of society started to drop off. We lost our community service crew. We lost our all of our cognitive programs. Any programs that we had that we were paying for via parole and probation and grant and aid funds went away. We had to protect the sanctions and warrants, had to have POs in the office to do those things. So at this point in Baker County, the only program that we have that we're paying any money for is through Measure 57 dollars. And we are so small that we get the minimum grant aid, which is $25,000 a year. That's not a lot of money to run a program. I can't hire a staff member, can't hire a treatment program, and so we've partnered with our local providers and anybody that we could basically beg, borrow, or convince them to help our population out. We've been very, very lucky in our area that our community partners have recognized that we are in dire straits with our budget. And they have done above and beyond what I could ever imagine our treatment providers doing. Right now, we started a jail treatment program, and it's a one day a week for a couple hours, just cognitive treatment. But there's no way that if we actually added up the dollars that what I'm paying them out of the Measure 57 grant would even half count for their time. They're doing this because it's the right thing to do. Unfortunately, I'm burning them up, and that's my biggest concern is I don't know how much longer that our community partners can carry the weight that, in my opinion, we should be doing. These offenders need the cognitive treatment. They need the alcohol and drug treatment, and supervision alone doesn't work. We've known that. The studies have shown that for years. It alone does not work. Treatment alone doesn't work. It's the combination of the two that makes things work, changes these offenders into productive members, so they're paying back. It gets them out of the system. And luckily, like I said, our community partners have allowed that to continue in our county. But it's definitely not to the level it was back in 2007. And that's unfortunate. We've had to dismantle a lot of the program, even in the short period I've been in Baker County, that we started back in 2007. It's disheartening, not only to me, but to our community members. Our drug court has went away. There's a number of things that have just left. We just do not have the resources to do it. And I guess when I really, really look at it, we want to be proactive. That's the every community corrections office in the state wants to be proactive. And with the way that the budget is, it's getting harder and harder and harder. I think that we've done everything that we can do as far as leaning on our community partners and trying to be creative with the population that we have to make positive changes. And I just worry that we're burning those folks out. Mark was saying, you know, Umatilla County is a small county. Well, if Umatilla County is small, Baker's tiny. We're very, very small. Like I said, I have three probation officers and myself in the office. At any given time, it can take upwards of 5 hours to get from one point of our county to the other. So it becomes a safety issue for my team. And I do worry about them. Every one of our vehicles has over 130,000 miles on it. It's only a matter of time before they break down. But we're still trying to focus all of our energies on the treatment programs. Anything that we can afford to do, we're just, okay, well, we're going to put a Band-Aid on that to try to keep it so we can actually make changes in the offenders. And I feel like we're just about done where we can't be proactive anymore. Like I said, I'm lucky I have a team that is so energized and wants to do the work, and you know they put in a lot of time and a lot of hours, and we do a lot with our, like I said, with our community partners. Hopefully, we can see some changes in the budget so we can get that program back up to where we're being successful and making changes without strapping our entire community. And before I came to this meeting today, I was at the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and the smaller counties said, please let the committee know that it's not just Baker County that's having this issues, that it's all small counties, and even the large counties are having issues. And if there is an infusion of dollars from somewhere, then they're all at the same spot where Baker County is, and that is we are at a skeleton crew and trying to do the best with what we have. What I can tell you is this, we're not going to quit fighting the good fight. That we will absolutely not. Until somebody tells me that I can't come to work to do my job, I'm going to show up every day. We don't want to stop. We want to make changes in this population, and we're dedicated to do that. I'm just hopeful that the budget can find a way to at least try to give back to community corrections what we've had in the past, and that's the ability to be proactive and the ability to make changes in this population. we really do want to try, and I think we're doing good work. We've seen a lot of amazing things in the last several years, even with the budget numbers going down. I can only imagine what it would be like if we could get some funding. And I don't mean to come here and beg for money, and that's what it sounds like. It sounds like I'm preaching the doom and gloom. That's definitely not my intent. But I would just hope that you would see that the work we're doing is valuable, and hopefully we can continue to make good things. And with that, if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Representative Guerra.
So I'd actually like you to do more than imagine. I actually want to know if we not only hadn't seen the 20% cut to community corrections in the last budget, but if we could begin to reinvest, what would just paint the picture in terms of how you see outcomes changing if we begin to put resources back in?
Thank you. With the adding of resources, I know we can build our programs back up. It's going to take some time because we've lost the infrastructure. And with the amounts of reduction we've had, as just in my shop alone, to lose my community service work crew supervisor, to lose clerical, to lose those different functions, it's going to take time to get those pieces back up and running. We know community service makes a difference in offender behavior. That's one of our best sanctions that we can use. That's something that changes their behavior. They don't like to go out on work crew. It's a reformation piece to the community. They see these offenders working. And then the treatment piece. Basically, we have just been begging and pleading treatment providers to take our offenders, to have some funds for indigent offenders, inmates coming out of the institutions that absolutely have nothing. This is a way to get them at least started in treatment. And that's all we had before, was just enough money to get them started and then work on the job readiness, getting them employed so that they could pay for their own treatment. And I think that's important. I think it's something they should do. But without that ability to even start, we have an offender in the community that's untreated, and what the likelihood of them returning to that same custody setting is huge, because all we're doing is having an eyeball on them. That doesn't mean that they're not doing all the other things that they can do, and they're not getting help in the areas that they need help in. Transitional leave, like we've been discussing, 30 days transitional leave for us, while it's great, it doesn't do a whole lot. We need that transitional leave period to be 90 days. That way we can work with the individuals before they're even eligible for transitional leave, get them out on transitional leave, get their routines established before they even hit post-prison supervision. And any programs we build in Baker County are going to be applicable to the probation, the 12 months or less sentence folks, or the folks coming out of prison. It doesn't matter. We can apply that to all of those. And that, with that money, that's exactly what we would do, is programs first, get those programs back engaged so that we can get those offenders rolling.
Thanks.
Senator Winters, did you have something?
No, he answered my question. Thanks.
Senator Pozanski.
Lieutenant, just following up on your response, I'm assuming the more flexibility with the reentry reinvestment money that we could get to you would be better, so your county would be able to use it in the ways that it deems most appropriate.
Absolutely, and we would appreciate that very much. And I think it's going to be different in every county on how that would look, and to pigeonhole, you have to use the money for this. While that may work in Salem or in Marion County, it may not be the most effective use of resources in Baker County. We have jail space. We have the ability to roll people out of the institutions early to our jail. We're at a luxury in that boat. There are many counties that do not have that, and that's something that we would love to do. It makes more sense for me to have access to that person with my probation officers face to face, not just over the telephone. And I think that that's something we would definitely like to see. But yes, I to answer your question, and sorry, I get on my soapbox a little bit, I apologize. But I think it's very appropriate to give that flexibility to the different counties.
If I can follow up.
Proceed.
I mean, it actually follows up with what you've testified. 30 days is okay, but 90 is going to give you better. And if you got the room to actually accommodate them and start working with them, you have that, let's say, better chance for success.
Yes, sir. And can we start tomorrow where we're ready to go?
Yeah.
Mark, you want to jump in on any of that? Or
no, I would just echo what Will has said. We definitely would make good use of the money. Like Will said, I think we're good stewards of the public's money, and it's effective. And it costs less. And I think that's really what we're trying to address here. Oregon is in a situation where they can't afford to lock everybody up. And I think we're effective, and we've shown that over time. Last thing I would just say is I appreciate all the committee members and co-chairs. You've been tasked with a very large item for Oregon, and thank you.
Well, I think I can speak on behalf of all of us here. I mean, we appreciate what you do. I mean, you're kind of the gateway. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Senator Pozanski, did I hear room tax? Is that what I heard from you? Okay. Just, thank you. Wow, okay.
That's Betty.
Chew on that one for a little bit. Okay, Captain Chris Hoy, you've got a group of folks with you.
I do.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, I'm Captain Chris Hoy with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. I'm the Director of Community Corrections there, and I'm really pleased to be able to speak with you today. I'm almost a little bit embarrassed to be getting up here after my colleagues from Eastern Oregon, because I'm going to paint a little bit different picture for you. You've asked the questions today, what works with transition and that sort of thing, and I can tell you that in Clackamas County we have a really strong record of success when it comes to prison releases and folks transitioning back to our community. I'm really pleased to have some guests here today who will be able to speak to that in real life terms. I'm going to tell you some of our programs, describe them to you, but we have our two peer mentors here today, and then two of our successful clients with us today who will be able to speak to you in what these things mean in real life. So thank you for that opportunity. When we talk about transition and release back into our community in Clackamas County, we really talk about four things. We're talking about release planning and investigation, transitional housing, and peer mentors, and then employment assistance. And I'm just going to go through each one of those briefly with you. When we talk about release planning and investigation, we work closely with our partners at the Department of Corrections, and we actually send a parole and probation officer and a peer mentor into the institution whenever they're over on the west side, and we do it via teleconference otherwise. But we actually send a PO and a mentor into the prison, like, up to 6 months prior to release, to actually meet with that client and start that planning process right up front. We start talking to them about any responsivity issues, things that are going to help them be successful on their supervision. We look at mental health issues, because those things can take an especially long time to establish once they're in the community. We look at veterans issues to see if we need to hook them into with the veteran services. We look at alcohol and drug issues, because sometimes if they haven't had the opportunity for treatment in custody, you know, we want to arrange for something when they get out, and those sometimes there's waiting lists, things like that. And so we start that process up to 6 months prior to release, and we really see that as a beneficial way to get that relationship established. So we have one staff member dedicated. That's all she does is meet with folks in prisons and plan for their release, investigate the potential residents in our county. She goes out and visits every home to decide whether or not it's going to be a good fit, approves the release plan or denies it, works on modifying it, that sort of thing. And like I said, the mentors go right along with her when they're meeting with those clients. So they begin establishing a rapport before the person ever leaves. The next thing we do, we have transitional housing. And our primary transitional housing was with a nonprofit agency called Bridges to Change. And we have a contract with them where we have a 40-bed apartment building in our county where every person getting out of prison in Clackamas County is guaranteed a clean and sober place to live. Nobody goes homeless when they're coming out of prison in Clackamas County. And I'm probably the only community corrections director that can get up here and say that. We're very fortunate, and we very much attribute our success to that, to having that resource. So we have 90-day place for them to stay. It's like I said, it's clean and sober. It's monitored urinalysis testing. It's an independent but semi-structured environment where they have a curfew. They have responsibilities. They're living with other folks in an apartment. It's not single-person apartment, that kind of thing. And then we also connect them with our mentors. And the mentors are really, and they'll describe here in a few minutes what they actually do. But what I can tell you is that they start just immediately developing a rapport. Oftentimes, we had a gentleman just last week get out of prison. I don't know how long he'd been in prison, 20 years, 25 years. And Doug Van Zandt, one of our peer mentors, was in our office when he arrived. He was actually transported to us by the DOC because he had no resources. Doug was there, met with him in our lobby, and they established that rapport. And he was able to take him out in the community, he's a very hard to place individual because of his crimes. He's a sex offender. So we have a lot of challenges that way. And Doug was able to really help him start out successfully in our community, where without that support, I can almost guarantee you, he would have been back in jail within a couple of days. There's no doubt about it. So like I said, it's a 90-day program. We also have in addition to our 40-bed apartment building, we also have some specialized housing. We do have a house specific for sex offenders, and we also have mental health housing, where we have a 14-bed men's house that Bridges to Change runs for us, where we put men with Axis 1 diagnoses. And we also have a couple of beds we've reserved at our recently at our women's facility for women with an Axis 1 diagnosis. We don't have an actual house yet. That's sort of our next goal, is to get an actual residence for women with mental illness in our county. So we also, in addition to those services, we have we operate an 80-bed work release facility and for men, and a 34-bed work release facility for women. And within those two facilities, we have inpatient alcohol and drug treatment programs for both men and women. And so we actually operate that program ourselves in partnership with our local mental health department, our county behavioral health. And so we actually, whereas my colleagues are often having to go to outside providers to get their folks into treatment, we actually run our own program, which very much contributes to our success with our clients. Like I mentioned earlier, that we have the peer mentors. We have every mentor has up to 20 clients each, so they're able to establish a really good rapport with folks. They'll help them with transporting them to job interviews, to getting them to recovery meetings, 12-step meetings. They'll help them with treatment, all sorts of things in the community. They're kind of the eyes and ears of the PO within the community. So they work very closely with my staff in keeping tabs on the client, just knocking down barriers that are, that could prevent them from being successful. And the mentors, probably if I had to pick just one of these programs to keep, that'd be the one I would keep, because I think they're so critical, the peer mentors. We see that in the mental health realm. We see that all over, where peer mentors are so important in this kind of environment. The other thing that we do is we have employment services. We have a contract with Community Solutions of Clackamas County, where we actually can send folks to intensive job readiness training. We recently got a Department of Labor grant for with a primary focus on women, and it'll provide career readiness jobs. So it's not just a survival job that we're trying to get for the folks. We're actually trying to get them into a career field. We focused on manufacturing, greenhouse, nursery, office, and non-traditional jobs for women, including apprenticeships and trades. And so that program will pay, it'll pay for daycare, it'll pay for reimburse the wage for a period of time. It has a lot of flexibility because it's a Department of Labor grant, a federal grant, which is just an amazing resource. We're really lucky. I think we're one of four or five counties across the country that got that grant. And then also just our mentors have so many leads and connections within the community. They know employers who are willing to work with our clients, and they will connect. They'll have people ready for a job interview on the day they get out, and they'll be able to tell you about that here in a moment. And we recently, with our WICO partners, the Workforce Investment Council of Clackamas County, recently created a video that we're taking out to the Chambers of Commerce in our county to make a business case for hiring our clients, which we think is really important. We've got a lot of people in the business community within our county who are willing to take a chance. Places like Dave's Killer Bread, lots of places like that who are willing to. They're great partners for us, and because we know that having a job is so critical in success once you're releasing into the community. And with that, I don't have anything else to say. I'll be happy to answer questions now or when we're done completely or whenever you'd like me to. But otherwise, I will introduce Doug Van Zandt. He's a program manager with Bridges to Change. And Terry Collins, who is a mentor with Bridges to Change also.
Okay, Roy, you want to just go ahead and go on through then?
Great. Thank you.
Good evening, Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for having us up here and to talk to you guys tonight. Before I get started with our program staff,
if you'd identify yourself first.
Oh, I'm Doug Van Zandt. I'm the program manager for Bridges to Change, Clackamas County.
Thank you.
Before I get started with our Bridges to Change staff, I was released from prison on June 28th of 2002, and when I was released, I was able to have a mentor that would pick me up at the gate when I was released and help me facilitate a lot of stuff that I didn't know anything about because of my addiction. I didn't operate real good, and my mentor helped me get clean and sober housing, helped me get clothing, helped me get a bus pass, took me to DMV, and helped me get my ID card, helped me get food stamps, and he also helped me do a resume because I obviously didn't have the skills to do all that stuff when I wasn't doing the right thing. And, you know, and the mentor was attached to me about 6 months after I was released. And when I was on parole, I was able to take the experience from working with a mentor on a daily basis to make some positive changes in my life, and I was got off supervision over a year early, and you know, I haven't looked back since. I've been very fortunate to have some good people in my life when I first got out of prison to show me how to live the right way. Today, I'm the program manager for Bridges Change in Clackamas County. What my focus is I provide all transitional services from everybody coming out of a state institution to Clackamas County. Mr. Hoy said, that everybody coming out of the state institution is guaranteed a bed in our county. The key piece for us is that we get to start working with the inmates 6 months before they're released. We get to go inside with the transition PO, and we get to build that relationship with the client and work on his plan. And a lot of guys, when they're just getting released, they have a lot of anxiety and don't know, they don't want to reoffend, but they don't know how to live. And so the key piece for us is that I start building that relationship 6 months before they get out. By the time they get out, we're on first name basis. They acknowledge who I am, and I always share my experiences and my story of when I wasn't doing good with the particular client. And the first 3 days, once they get out, you know, we pick them up at the gate so they can't get, so that way we get to them and they make it to probation. And the first 3 days, we spend all day with them as far as getting the food stamps, helping them get the bus pass, the basic needs. And we also provide a safe environment for them to transition to. It's accountability. They have to be checking in and talking to their mentor every day, be involved with activities with their mentor every day. And also, we help them. We meet them on their level and help them build up to the level that they can be on the self-sufficiency. One of the key components is in our relationship. Okay, we got their basic needs taken care of. We got their housing. We got their clothing. We got their food stamps. So they got their basic needs taken care of. And then we start helping them build positive support in the community. And whether it be their choice of support group meetings, church, 12-step meetings, we have a lot of experience in that field also. And the one of the key components that we have at Clackamas County and Bridges Change, we're averaging getting the inmate a job within 10 to 14 days. And we do that by having a good rapport with most employers that, you know, they're willing to take a chance on people that have addiction issues, crime issues, and we've been real successful with that. And we have a lot of our graduates of our program. They can stay in our housing up to 90 days for free. We have a lot of graduates in our program that are now managers of their own companies, lead foremen. We have a lot of resources in the Clackamas County area that we can make a phone call and let the person know that we got this guy that's really trying, but he doesn't have any job skills. And they're willing to take that chance. And it's really important, you know, that they have a self-sufficiency in place because they have 90 days in free housing. One of the other things that we like to do once they complete our 90-day program is we have six other houses in Clackamas County that they can pay rent at. It's clean and sober housing, accountability, pro-social activities, and they're very nice houses. And people really like to transition there because they don't want to be that person they once were. And we feel very fortunate that we have these services available. And as far as working together as a team with the probation officers, they're very client-centered in the Clackamas County, and they meet people at their levels and help them be successful. And we have a lot of treatment providers we work with, and also a lot of other resources we work with as a team, and we case plan it together. And the key component that I think is that we start working with the individual offender 6 months before they returned out of prison. So that way they have a little knowing where they're going to be going and know they have a safe place, and they know that they got an opportunity with people helping them. And with our prior experience as mentors, we know where they're at when they come out and how scary it is. And we really appreciate that opportunity to work with the offender coming out. I look forward to going into prison and talking with these people to try and help them.
Okay. Representative Garrett.
Yeah, I appreciate that testimony a lot. I just want to ask a question. You mentioned you've had a pretty good success placing people in employment within 10 to 14 days.
Yep.
How important has the fact that you have this peer mentoring program been to getting employers willing to take a chance on some of these people? Is that a factor they say is important?
Well, they like people that are clean and sober that can pass UAs, and also people that are willing to make a commitment to their change. And the commitment to change starts at the process of the six. When we're talking to them at 6 months from the gate, when we go in and see the person, at first, the first time we talk to them, they're a little weary because they've done it a lot of time. They don't know what their expectations are when they get out. And then once we build that relationship, once we talk to them in prison, they're feeling real comfortable. And our statistics show that. And as far as your question about the employer thing, we have a lot of people in the Clackamas County area that the mentors actually go in with the client and talk to the human resource manager saying, this is his background. Felonies question on the application is always yes, and this is what we're doing about it. We're here to make positive change in somebody's life. And so once we started that process, the employer is really – really warm to that.
If I could also respond to that, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Garrett. The other part of that is that Doug is not mentioning is that Doug and Terry and the other mentors have developed a really good reputation in our community. They've developed a really solid reputation with these employers. So they, if Doug calls and says, look, I think you should give this guy a shot, they know, they sort of have his seal of, you know, approval on it. And of course that's not a guarantee, mm-hmm. but they're very good at reading people and understanding human behavior and knowing whether it's somebody that they're willing to make that call on. And if they don't make that call, then the employer probably knows, you know, maybe they're not such worth the risk, you know, or they might be more calculated with that. But these guys have a great reputation in terms of with the employers. And so they know when they get the phone call from one of our mentors, they know that it's worth the chance because they know that there's a support system around that person. It's not just the person coming in on their own. There's supports around. They know that they're going to be clean and sober because they know the minute that somebody has a dirty UA, they're kicked out of housing,
mm-hmm.
period. With no questions asked.
We actually have employers call us, asking us if we have anybody. So it's nice.
Okay, good. Thank you. Terry?
My turn?
Terry, yes.
Good evening, co-chairs. For the record, my name is Terry Collins. I'm the female mentor for Clackamas County Bridges to Change, and I'm also a recovering addict. I know that Captain Hoy and Doug Van Zandt have given you a lot of information about the basics of the program, and so being a woman, I'm probably going to talk a little bit more about the touchy-feeling kind of stuff. So
thanks for the warning.
Yeah, here it comes. I have a history. I started using when I was 12 years old, and I got clean when I was 38. So that took me through a lot of trips to county jail, state prison. Did two stints in prison, and so what it took for me was a near-death overdose, and I got a moment of clarity, which I decided that I didn't want to die like that. So I got clean 14 years ago, and so for me, I didn't get clean to decide I want to help people. You know, I got an office job, and some things changed in my life, and I heard about Bridges to Change, and I decided that I'd never heard of anything like that. I'd never heard of a place where people could go where it was safe, and I wanted to be a part of that. So I've been with Bridges to Change for 3 years now, and like Doug said, and like Chris said, you know, it's an amazing program. It gives people an opportunity coming out of incarceration to come to a safe place. And for the women that I work with, a lot of them have never had that in their whole life. And so they come in with trust issues. They come in with self-esteem issues. They come in with addiction issues, mental health. I mean, they have just an array of barriers. And so, all the things that we talked about, the employment piece, helping them with the resources, accessing all those different things. And there's also the human component. I have a lot of experience in not doing the right thing. You know, it took me a lot of years to get off paper. And then I have 14 years experience of getting a job, showing up for work every day, like getting credit cards in my own name. I mean, is that crazy? Who does that? So, all these things that I can be a role model to these women and show them that they don't have to continue to do the things that they were doing. So, we also provide an extra level of accountability. There's support and accountability. Like Doug said, we work very closely with the POs involved. We're in contact almost daily to make sure that if there's any problems coming up, we catch it right away. You know, we're there. We're full-time hands-on. I'm not babysitters. I'm not going to use that word, but we're full-time. We're there. So we also provide, once a person is employed, we have an enforced savings account. So they get a job, they get a paycheck, they come to us, they bring their pay stub, because, not all of them might be 100% honest. So we have them bring their pay stub, and they turn in half to a savings account that we hold on to them, the money for them, and when it's time for them to go, they get that back. That's their next step to clean and sober housing, typically Oxford. Bridges to Change also has transitional houses where they can pay rent. They can move in there and they can stay as long as they want. So, it's a wraparound service. I'm passionate about what I do. I have seen amazing successes. I have seen women come in there on my caseload that did not want to be there, that their release plan was denied, and they came in a little bit resistant and were able to get the benefits from the program anyway and thank us after 90 days and say, that was the best thing that could have happened for me. So I think I've said everything I need to say. So thank you for inviting me here. I'm truly honored to be able to speak to you. Thank you.
Senator Winters.
They know that I'm going to say something. First, I want to thank both of you for being and sharing your testimony with us. And then I just have to say to my little neighborhood child that's in the center there, Sam's our loss in Marion County. You've done very well in Clackamas County. Mm-hmm. He grew up with my children, so. But no, truly, you sit here and you've told the story, and everybody knows my story, and so does the good Captain Hoy, that you prove that success can happen. And you prove that you can actually return back to a community and be a positive a role in the community. I just want to, you know, say thank you for sharing that with us here today. And I like your, you know, you talked about the 6 months. And there's one thing that stuck with me, because I don't think a lot of people understand. You talked about them feeling safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting because we think just the opposite, that we're being safe from you.
Mm-hmm.
But not recognizing that the reality is that they are fearful of us, because they don't know how to respond when you come out and you've been incarcerated for years and years. You have been told what to do, when to do, how to do it, didn't have a savings account, did not have relationships, and so suddenly you're being asked to mainstream or to become a part of a greater society. So I think you told the story well, and I thank you very much for it, and the best to you both, and good luck.
Thank you.
Sarah Brzezinski.
Thank you. Doug, this is really for you. I want to thank you for being here, as well as Terry, but I caught in your testimony where you said that you were released early from your post-prison supervision because of how well you did.
Yeah, what happened is I got out and didn't want to go back to my lifestyle no more. And I was able to have a mentor pick me up out of prison. And the only thing I knew was drug abuse and, you know, living that lifestyle. And I didn't want to go back there. I got involved with people that were doing the right thing. I stuck with the winners, even though it was something different for me. And, you know, sometimes it takes a while for everything to click in. What I did know, I never wanted to go back to prison. And I wanted to do things right. So, you know, I just stuck with the winning people and built a great relationship with my probation officers, which I'd never had before. And, you know, I got a job. I stayed in recovery. You know, I did a lot of service work. And my passion when I first got out of prison, not only to stay out of prison, but after I started hanging out with these people, I go, I want to be like that. I want to help. I want to be a difference in the community. I'm about public safety and want to, you know, help people that are growing up live the right way. So I just stayed with that program, and my probation officer says, there's no reason to keep you any longer. I'm terminating you, you know, over a year early. And, you know, that's the very first.
I can follow up.
Continue.
So, I mean, based on that, what I'm hearing is that this was kind of like an incentive based on how well you did. You got, you know, say rewarded.
I didn't think, I didn't know they had that then.
Yeah.
I just... Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, they gave that to you in the sense of, and
yeah.
So I guess based on your experience, one of the things that the commission or committee is looking at is setting up maybe some type of what we call incentive-based programs, mm-hmm. such as if someone comes out, they're on post-prison supervision, as they do well, they get acknowledged for that and maybe get off of post-prison supervision well or earlier than what they would be scheduled to if they'd have done well. Because what I'm hearing is what we keep on talking about is how do you integrate somebody back into the system? And then the system says that if you do a good job, you're going to get a pay raise or maybe get a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your comments for any of you would be for that.
I start off seeing my probation officer every week. That was the life because of my lifestyle. And pretty soon I didn't hardly have to see him hardly at all. And then one day I came and seen him. I said, yeah, I don't need to see you no more. I'm going to let you off. And, you know, because I paid all my fines. I was very responsible, very honest, because that's who I am today. And also I want to be a difference. I want to make a difference in the world rather than be a problem in the world. And I just portrayed that. And I actually did it inside my heart, too. To be the better person. And so the incentive, so yes, I wanted to be off supervision early, and that was an incentive. And also, I didn't want to live that lifestyle no more because I had people in my life that was surrounding me. My mentor was like attached to my hip everywhere I went. He was like, okay, keep doing the right thing. And it worked, you know. And that's how I am today. I'm with my clients on a daily basis. You know, I wake them up at 6:30 in the morning at the apartment complex, and sometimes I come back at 10 o'clock at night to see if they're there and just check in with them. So, you know, because I care about people today. I care about myself today, and I care about the program today, and I want to make a difference, you know.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain White, your population of any city you've got in Clackamas County is bigger than Curry County's whole population. We don't have the capacity. Can you talk a little bit about how many people are in your entire program? Is it because it's larger, it has a capacity to sustain itself? I can't imagine that this something that, you know, to this magnitude, it would work on a smaller scale, but I don't see it happening in a lot of those rural communities.
Representative Krieger and members of the committee, thank you for the question. Well, that's an interesting question. We have about 3,500 folks on supervision at on any given day in Clackamas County. That's on all forms of supervision, parole, post-prison supervision, probation. And you're right. I think in some of the smaller counties, they do have challenges when it comes to program size and that sort of thing. But there are ways, especially, you know, like we work with a nonprofit agency like Bridges to Change, where they, you know, they operate also in Washington County, and they operate some in Marion County and Multnomah County. And so they have more of a critical mass that they, when they put together, because they're not restricted by county boundaries like, say, a community corrections agency would be. But I don't think there's anything keeping those agencies maybe from working together to create a program, you know, and that sort of thing. But in terms of, to answer your question a little bit more directly about how we managed to keep this program going, honestly, almost all the programs I talked about today aren't paid for by the state grant and aid. They're paid for by Clackamas County General Fund dollars. And one of the very few counties that actually gets county general fund dollars to support community corrections. And so that's how we've been able to, because the county commissioners have stepped up and have provided supplemental funding. Last year, you know, when we had the mid-biennium cut, I had, you know, they stepped up with $800,000. But that was only thanks to the fact that their Secure Rural Schools Act got refunded by Congress. Else we would have been, I lost 14 FTE as it was last year. I would have been losing several more had that not happened.
Okay. Senator Winters.
Quickly, you mentioned, Mr. Van Sant, that you paid your restitution. Do all the offenders, as they return, pay their restitution, number one? And then, Chris, because I know some others want to ask questions, have you done a calculation on employment and how much in tax revenue has been generated by individuals because they're now employed and they're working and they're now have become contributors to our society?
Senator Winters and members of the committee, thank you for that. We have not done that calculation, but I understand that maybe the Criminal Justice Commission is going to be looking at those types of things in the future, and we would be very interested in having that information. I can tell you anecdotally stories about, you know, our clients becoming employed, but I don't have any actual figures for you. You know, but obviously, folks who receive a paycheck are, you know, contribute in lots of ways to the economy, to the tax base, everything, and more so than people who take from it.
Senator Winters, everybody that's at day 60 in our program, they got to be paying their court fines and supervision fees, restitution fees. Yeah, when they hit 60 days in our program, that's part of our program to be accountable. They got to be making the effort to be accountable themselves and make sure they pay those.
Representative Garrett.
It's just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. I thought the exchange between Representative Krieger and Mr. Hoy kind of in 2 minutes summarized what this effort is all about better than I could ever do it. I mean, we know these programs work. Clackamas County clearly has a nonprofit infrastructure and a general fund that can support these on a scale that Curry County and many other counties in the state can't do, which is exactly why the amount of grant funding from the state has to increase in those areas to compensate for what we can't get anywhere else. It's the only option we have.
Chair.
Go ahead.
It's to the point our sheriff is planning on resigning at the end of June. and shutting down the jail and laying everybody off. That's where we are. And, you know, we've known this is coming for years, and yet there's such a great need. Now, these stories I've heard tonight are very encouraging because these people got their life back. How many more? How many of those have wives, husbands, children? There's a value there that you can't take and put a dollar sign on.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, congratulations on a job well done. It's very impressive, and I think it gives us a lot of hope of what's possible. And I appreciate your work very much. I just had a specific question about your housing. You said you had the 40-bed apartment building, the 80-bed work release. How have you been able to fund your housing?
Senator Close and members of the committee, the housing itself was actually specifically funded by the Board of County Commissioners, that they actually gave us the specific amount we needed to pay for that program. It's not something that we pay for with state grant and aid dollars, although because we have, you know, one of the other programs you mentioned was our work release and our inpatient, we measure 57 grant dollars to fund that. That frees up other money to pay for this. You know, it all goes together to fund our priorities, and the county commissioners have been very generous in their support. But every year I go back and I'm never sure if that's going to continue. I'm not at all sure it's going to continue this year because the county budget overall is very tight. And so I sent layoff notices last year, or I informally sent layoff notices to staff saying I'm closing a building on June 30th. And luckily the commissioners came through and saved the day. But I lost staff members who went and looked for work elsewhere because I could no longer, you know, tell them that this program was going to continue. So that's
you're leasing the buildings, is that correct?
No, they're county-owned buildings. It's county-owned buildings on state property that we lease from the state, actually. But the building we own, it's a modular kind of building. But we've mothballed it before. We just reopened it in 2008. So it's been opened and closed and opened and closed.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the information. You know, obviously, I think, you know, Mark and Will, we appreciate you coming all the way over here. And Chris, Doug, and Terry, we thank you too. And Shane, thank you very much. You get what's going on here. It's kind of critical. Pardon me? Well, you have two more folks?
Yeah. Representative Olson, I actually have two more guests who are recent clients, who are recent success stories. They've come all the way down. I would love for them to be able to tell their story.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well,
thank
disregard
you.
Them what I just said.
Thank you. Thank you.
He'll say it again.
Representative Olson, I have Michelle
Fabian. 12:43.
I have Michelle Fabian, who participated in the LIFT program at Coffee Creek and was released to us in 2011. And I have Frank Zaccone, who was an AIP participant and released from Powder River into Clackamas County in 2011. So they have, they're here to tell their stories today, too. So, who would like to go first?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Frank Zaccone. I am an AIP graduate and a Bridges to Change graduate. I'm not sure where to start, so I'll start at the beginning. I spent the majority of my life running myself through a knothole backwards, to the extent that the state found that I wasn't even fit to walk down the street to go to 7-Eleven. I needed to be locked up because of my personal accountability and my integrity was non-existent. With that being said, I did 4 years in the Department of Corrections in Oregon. I had 19 property crime felonies that I was convicted of, so I apparently did it right to get there, that's for sure. Through my stay in the Department of Corrections, I took as many cognitive programming that they offered, GED, parenting. There's a plethora of them. I ended up at the beginning of 2010 at Powder River in Baker City. I went through their six-month inpatient program for behavioral therapy. With that being said, I spent a large majority of my life with a thought process that led to poor choices and negative outcomes and just a whole lot of things that people really don't want to enjoy. And the ability to brainwash, for lack of a better term, something into my brain that was going to work when I got out the door in a small amount of time of 180 days is it's tough. It needs to be extremely strategic, and it has to be extremely structured. And with that being said, it minimized my ability to have an objective perspective in that program, because they had a lot of work to do in a very small amount of time. So essentially what I ended up with was a restructured brain and a whole lot of tools that had never been dry fired. They'd never been test driven, nothing. They sent me to the door. When I got out, I left there as the CC, which is the head of my community. When I got out, I came to Portland. When I got to Portland, it was I got into a Dollar Tree to buy a few things, some pens and papers. Almost had a meltdown just because of the transition was so uncomfortable. My dad brought me to town, brought me right to Bridges to Change. I met my mentor, Joey. And what Bridges to Change did for me was took a very uncomfortable situation and made it comfortable to work with. Joey ran me around, got my ID back together, got my Social Security card, helped me figure out a few things. They gave me some housing. When I got to Oregon City, I'd never spent any time in Oregon City at all. But due to the rules at AIP, that was the county that I was on supervision with when I went to prison and was incarcerated. So I lived in the housing. I talked to Joey every day. What they provided was structure and routine for me. That's something I could grab onto and begin building a foundation for some sort of a semblance of life that made sense, that was productive and responsible. And that whole journey actually began on November 4th of 2010 is when I paroled. So relatively close to 2011, yes. In that amount of time since then, I've gotten married. I've gotten custody of my 5-year-old daughter, which I don't know how familiar you are with men getting custody of 5-year-old little girls in Oregon, but it's an obstacle sometimes. I am a shop foreman and field superintendent for the company I work for. I don't answer to anybody but the owner. None of my bills have been shut off since I've been out. I couldn't even tell you how long I'm on supervision for, because it's inconsequential to me. It doesn't dictate why I do what I do. One of these days, they'll send me back $35 because I sent them an extra payment. I don't know when that's going to be, you know. But it certainly doesn't dictate what I do on a daily basis. I do it because it's right. I do it because I like to go to 7-Eleven and get a Slurpee, you know. I have a great time. I don't know what else to say other than, without Bridges to Change, my foundation for a pyrrhic success as I've had so far in life, I don't believe it would have been as readily available to me, and I don't think it would have been it wouldn't have worked out quite so well for me, I don't think. So I really appreciate the program that they have, and it did me a whole lot of good. So thanks.
That's good. Thank you. Michelle?
Hi. Thank you, members of the committee, senators. My name is Michelle Fabian. I was released on 12/9/2011. And I've heard a lot here today, accountability and safety, which Terry hit on, which was very important. But the one thing that was really important to me about the transition and the change was the hope. I finally had some hope in my life. I was originally charged with 5 counts forgery, 5 counts theft many years ago. I did pay all my restitution, but remained on probation for a very long time. And there was no incentive of getting off early. And I kept absconding. Unfortunately, that did bring me back. I made many poor choices, and a lot of them revolving around men and abusive men. But I didn't realize that I had my own voice, or that I had any hope on my own to be something better than what I was. I also completed an AIP program, an amazing program at Coffee Creek, LIFT, which Vicki Spears was the director of, and that changed my life. That was a turning point for me. I was kind of an unusual case because I didn't have drug or alcohol addiction, but I did have mental health issues, which had not been treated. I'd been riding the roller coaster of bipolar, manic depression for years, and I would, I struggled. With that and a lot of other issues. And LIFT helped me so much, really put my life in perspective, make some important changes. And having Bridges to Change and Clackamas County meet me at Coffee Creek and show me that there was another way. I mean, that I was released with transition and with housing and mental health counseling and... it gave me that hope. It was a tremendous amount of hope. I completed the program at Bridges to Change, and I would have to say that the diploma I received at Coffee Creek for completing their cognitive program and the silly little diploma that I received at Bridges to Change were monumental in my changes and the infrastructure of my life now. I was able to enroll immediately. I had been taking classes at Coffee Creek through Portland Community College and PSU, and I completed the opticians program there. I worked in the gardening program, and I was actively involved in Girl Scouts Beyond Bars, which I'm still today actively involved in mentoring the mothers that are still incarcerated and their children. But Bridges to Change, Terry was my mentor, and she does handhold, but she guides you. And I think what I saw in Terry was somebody that I wanted to be, somebody that could also make a change and could reach out to people that maybe weren't necessarily addicted to drugs or alcohol, but had issues that a lot of people don't like to talk about or address, and that was the mental health issues and abuse issues. And I'm completing my master's in social work at Portland State right now, and I work with... a Cascade Mental Health Agency with Aging Services, and I'm really happy to be making those changes right now, and I couldn't do a lot of that without the help and the guidance that I received. And the incentive of an early release from probation was huge for me, and it was instrumental, and I've been moved to reduce supervision, and it told me that somebody really does believe in me. And I have, in 48 years of life, I've really not had that. And I was a reluctant participant at first at Bridges to Change. I thought everything was set that I was going to go home and live with my daughter and take care of my grandchildren and go to school. And because I was in the AIP program, that wasn't okay. I had to have 90 days. And I am grateful. I don't care how much I drug my boots in the beginning. I'm grateful for every day of that 90 days. And I transitioned to the housing from the apartment, from the 40-bed apartment complex to their housing. And I was encouraged the entire way. I went to work through the program at Transitions at Portland Community College, was hired there, and then continued on to PSU. And I'm on the fast track. And I couldn't be happier right now. So it really does work, and I think it's important that the communities are supported, small and large. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody?
I just would say I think the programs are great and obviously very needed, but you two have done your own work. You deserve a lot of personal credit. People get that finish those programs, you're doing a lot. I mean, like you say, that certainly that program is vital to help you along, but if you're not helping yourself, you still wouldn't succeed. And I'm just really glad to hear these stories are very encouraging. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay, we're done now, Josh.
Good to go.
Mr. Chair.
Right. Yes.
It also, I think, tells you where we need to make major investments in the state of Oregon. We actually know what works. We've talked privately, talked to you today. We got to make the commitment. That's what we got to do. We got to find a way to do it.
Sure. I agree. Chris, thank you very much for bringing
everybody. everybody.
Everybody, yes. Thank you very much tonight. This has been very informative for us. So I'm going to close the information hearing, and we are adjourned.